dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In this war, we have a backdrop that, amazingly, Americans have long since neglected, failed to think about, or particularly be concerned in applying the necessary resources to maintain. And that is, broadly defined, our strategic deterrent posture. It has become, if anything, more imperative today than at any time in the past that we attend to having the capacity credibly, safely, reliably, and effectively to deter others from thinking that they could possibly engage in nuclear attacks upon us, or, for that matter, any other kind of attacks under the cover of nuclear weapons. A man who has given a lot of thought to this, in fact, has arguably done as much as anybody to try to keep thinking alive, to keep policymakers in Washington particularly, and the public, alert to the issues that are involved, is our first guest. He is Peter Husey. He is the president of Geostrategic Analysis and the director of Strategic Deterrence Studies at the Air Force Association's Mitchell Institute. He has been sponsoring breakfasts and lunches and dinners in Washington for decades, in which he engages senior people, both in the executive branch and the military and on Capitol Hill, in discourse about nuclear deterrence, about missile defense, and more broadly about national security. And it's a tremendous public service, as are his visits with us from time to time. So it's great to catch up with him. Peter Husey, welcome back. Good to have you.
Welcome, Frank. I appreciate being on your radio show once again.
Good to have you. Let me ask you, Peter, to sort of introduce, and then we'll drill down in some detail on a very important piece that you had recently, I guess last month, in one of my favorite institutions' output, Gatestone Institute. You entitled it simply, Dangerous Nuclear Schemes. And I guess by way of introduction, you might just tell us who in positions of influence these days is indulging in such dangerous nuclear schemes.
Well, there are two people in the Congress, or three: Senator Markey of Massachusetts, Senator Warren of Massachusetts, and the current chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Mr. Smith. And to some degree, they have proposed policies such as no first use of nuclear weapons. Congress has to give President the authority to use nuclear weapons. They've talked about getting rid of one or two legs of the triad, our bombers and our ICBMs. And then others have talked about what is called you unplug the missiles we have on land. It's called de-alerting, which you can't verify, and you can put them back on alert in a matter of a keystroke on a computer board, so you wouldn't know whether they're alerted or de-alerted. And the posture is, the scary thing is, Mr. Smith of House Armed Services Committee is proposing, why don't we just adopt the Chinese minimal deterrent strategy, which is have 300 warheads versus the 1550 we are allowed under the New START Treaty, and we would do all these things unilaterally.
Okay, well, let's go through each of them in turn, Peter Husey, because I think they all warrant very close and critical examination. But we'll come back to, you know, the unilateralism here. But just to start with, what's the practical problem with putting into the nuclear command authority, that is to say, the system whereby nuclear weapons are given the go code, if God forbid they have to be used, of some sort of legislative authorization?
It's you ask yourself, what if the bad guys took out Congress first? And then, of course, the president would say, well, looks like that requirement's out the tubes. But it's stupid in the, given the fact the president has to be given the option of responding rapidly. But that doesn't mean he has to respond recklessly or without knowing all the facts. We're under no, there's no requirement that we respond within a few minutes of an attack. But once we have confirmed bad guy warheads landing on American soil, you're going to, then the president of the United States is going to respond. In what way we want to give that president as many possible options as possible, including not having to go to Congress to get permission to do something.
But Peter, let me just say, speak to the fact that the whole point of this exercise is not to have to launch any nuclear weapons. And how does that bear the idea that we might have this kind of Rube Goldberg arrangement interposed on the release authority? How would that be read?
Here's the real problem is there's a letter from our former governor of California, Mr. Brown, and Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense, and a whole series of lefty kind of luminaries that say that if the United States is attacked with nuclear weapons, we should not reply with nuclear weapons because no one can control the escalation that would follow. The argument being if one is used, they're all going to be used, and they're going to be used all in short order. And therefore, what the letter says is if we are attacked with nuclear weapons, as Bruce Blair, who's head of this Global Zero Project at Princeton University, said in testimony before the House Armed Services Committee on March 6th, he said he and Joan Rolfing, who's with the Nuclear Threat Initiative, both said to the committee, we would continue to fight with conventional weapons, even if the bad guys used nukes. So basically, you're giving a signal to the other guy, if you use nukes, we won't respond with nukes. And therefore, you basically vitiated the whole point of deterrence.
Right. But again, Peter Husey, you've been seriously studying and interacting with those who are practitioners of national security policy for, as I say, decades and decades and decades. What is the practical effect of doing this on the calculations of enemies who feel no constraints whatsoever, it seems, on the release of nuclear weapons against us?
I gave a speech the other just 2 days ago at the Air Force Base Global Strike Command in Barksdale in Louisiana. And I laid out the point that if you look at detente, peaceful coexistence, the peace process, reset, it all assumed that the bad guys were willing to show restraint, seek peace, and basically be a partner. And the difference is in from the Reagan, Nixon administration detente all the way up to where we are today, the one anomaly was Ronald Reagan's peace through strength that said, I'm not assuming the other guy's going to be our friend. So what you've decided in this crazy idea of not responding with nukes to a nuke attack, you've disarmed yourself, and you've given the other guy and message, which is if you attack me with nuclear weapons in the Baltics or the Taiwan or North, or the Korean Peninsula, you know, you pick your where you want to do it. We are not going to come back with you against you with our nukes. So our entire nuclear arsenal, which we have spent billions and billions of dollars to deploy, you've just taken it away from us.
Yeah, there it goes. Peter, we have to pause. We'll be right back with more with Peter Husey right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are continuing this important conversation with Peter Husey of Geostrategic Analysis and the Mitchell Institute's Strategic Deterrence Studies Program, which he directs. And Peter, we're going through this litany of dangerous nuclear schemes that we're hearing some, like Senators Markey and his colleague from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, and the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Let that sink in. Adam Smith, a guy who is in a key position to authorize the appropriation of funds for the national security. I think, persuasively argued that it is lunatic to essentially say Congress has to authorize the use of nuclear weapons if we wish to deter attack against us. I think similarly lunatic is another idea of these gang, namely the notion that we can safely de-alert, or as you put it, unplug the missiles that are land-based, our so-called intercontinental range ballistic missiles, or ICBM force. What's wrong with that idea, Peter Pusey?
Well, part of the idea was if the president is in a crisis situation and we see missiles coming over the pole, that if the systems are de-alerted, meaning unplugged, the president would have to take additional time in order to figure out, okay, plug them back in, and by that time we'd figure out, is the attack real or not? This is part of the fairy tale out there that a computer glitch is going to show us all these nuclear warheads coming at us from Russia, but it's going to be fake. That was an entire episode of Madam Secretary last year, was laid out. The whole show was dealt with de-alerting and killing Minuteman. And part of this idea is, well, if the missiles are sitting there and we have to use them or you lose them, that's the argument, that therefore, why not just get rid of them so the president doesn't have that temptation? Well, then what you're saying is instead of having over 500 nuclear assets that the bad guys have to come target to disarm us, they would be down to less than 10. Three bomber bases, two sub bases, and submarines at sea. But it gets even worse. Bruce Blair and Joe Cerencioni and Larry Korb, this crowd of disarmers, they want to go to five submarines, not 12. And five submarines would still have two submarine bases, but there would only be one submarine in the Pacific and one in the Atlantic, could not cover the targets they have to cover in Russia and China. So you basically would vitiate not just Minuteman, taking that gone, that goes away. And then the bombers, they want to get rid of the cruise missiles, so the bomber basically has to penetrate and take 16 hours to get there. But the subs wouldn't be able to do their job either. And so, and you can't verify de-alerting, and the Russians we could go back on alert, they could go back on alert, nobody would know the difference. So what's the point?
Well, arguably, we could go back on alert, but as a practical matter, that isn't how it would work, because you know Peter Pusey so well. But let me just ask you this, Peter. I mean, what we're talking about here, to be very clear, is the advocacy of unilateral nuclear disarmament by the United States. And you mentioned earlier, Peter, that Adam Smith is fancying this idea of having the Chinese minimal deterrent posture of 200 to 300 warheads. I talk with a lot of people on this program who say it's exceedingly unlikely that the Chinese actually have that few nuclear weapons any longer, that they've been secretly, covertly building very capable and very large nuclear forces. I'm always reminded of the fact that there's 3,000 miles of underground tunnels, hardened tunnels, in which they've stashed heavens knows what, but assuredly some number of road mobile, rail mobile, maybe intercontinental ballistic missiles. And we have no idea how many there are, let alone how they're loaded out. So, Peter, this is just crazy, reckless stuff, isn't it?
It goes to this issue of if the bad guys use nuclear weapons, deterrence is broken down, and then you're into war fighting, and they don't believe in nuclear war fighting, so they basically say, stand down. And the idea of 300 warheads gets to, well, the only thing you'd ever really use them for is go out and blow up their cities. You don't want to go after their weapons because that's war fighting and that's bad. So this crazy notion, which is, one, if they use nukes against us, we won't reply because it'll escalate out of control. But then second, they say you don't need very many even if you do want to reply, because you want to reply and just blow up a few cities, and nuclear weapons can miss New York by a quarter of a mile. Who cares? So the argument is that the Chinese only target our cities with massive megaton-type warheads. And as you has pointed out, those train tracks in those tunnels cost the Chinese $57 billion to build. And the platforms outside the tunnels where the missiles would be launched, those platforms are raised up in a way that are slanted or on a tilt. And as Mr. Carver has pointed out, the distance from those platforms to our three ICBM bases, Minot, North Dakota, Maelstrom, Montana, and F.E. Warren in Wyoming, that's exactly the distance those Chinese missiles can go fly. So basically, my view is, when Carver and I looked at this, we said they're going to go after our weapons.
Well, they're certainly having the option of doing that, that's for sure. But Peter, let me ask you this. When somebody tells you they're not interested in nuclear war fighting, it kind of reminds me of that old line, well, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. If the other guy is interested in, and more to the point, not just interested in, that can change at any moment, but they have the capabilities to engage in nuclear war fighting. They have the doctrine that says that's what they're going to do. And by the way, they telegraph that doctrine, not only in their public writings, but in their exercises, some of which are presided over by the head of state himself. This is crazy to say we're not interested in it.
Well, in April 2000, as General Hyten is our head of U.S. Strategic Command, who's the number one military officer in charge of our nuclear weapons, he said that in April 2000, Putin announced, we're going to use nuclear weapons either on a coercive basis to threaten or blackmail you or use them themselves in a crisis early. And they're going to be small weapons, maybe limited number, but we're serious about this. And then in 2006, he said, oh, by the way, we're going to build the following weapons and we're going to test them. And then in 2014, he said, oh, by the way, they're all going to be finished building them by 2021. And General Hyten has gone through this whole thing. And as your friend and my friend Mark Schneider has pointed out, I think 30 times since 2009, the Russians have explicitly threatened the United States and our allies with nuclear weapons. So they're serious about this stuff. And they're also serious about going first as a means of getting us to stand down and say no mas and just quit.
Escalate to de-escalate, I think, is the phrase that Putin has used, I think.
General Hyten says threaten to escalate to win. And as Sun Tzu said, you can fight if you can win a war without having to fight. That's the brilliance of a strategy, and that's what the Russians are up to.
But I think they've also actually adopted this strategy that they will use nuclear weapons to ensure that we don't or are unable to do so.
That's my worry, is how reckless is he as Mr. Putin?
You were talking about President Reagan, and one of the things, of course, that prompted President Reagan to pursue, as he did, that Strategic Force Modernization Program, which broke dramatically with the craziness of détente, was, of all people, as you remember, Harold Brown, Jimmy Carter's defense secretary, who just recently passed away, said famously, I think it was in congressional testimony, when we build, they build. When we stop building, they keep building. And that was about the Soviets at the time. But it's true today with respect to the Russians and Chinese. Just very quickly, Peter, give us a quick sense of how far along these other nations, Russia, China, for that matter, North Korea and Iran, are in terms of pursuing dramatic nuclear force modernization efforts compared to ours, particularly.
Russia's going to be done. Let me put it this way. As our friends have said, the Russians really don't stop. They modernize and then they start all over again. But Russia will be done most of everything by 2021, 2022.
Most of everything, meaning a full-on modernization. I think Mark Schneider, has said there's something like 20 different missile systems that have gone into this for the Russians.
Yes, that's true. And China, if you look at the numbers, they'll be done around 2027, 28, in that end of the next decade. That's when we deploy our very first bomber and then a submarine.
Assuming Adam Smith and his friends don't screw that up, which is why this conversation is so important. And Peter, lastly, talk about this issue of the survivability of our submarine force, which these minimal deterrence types are keen to, use as the last little bit of deterrence that we would have. What are the dangers that we may find that most survivable leg of the triad, as it's been thought of for many years, isn't so much in the future?
Well, this is the hedge you have to have, is as Brad Roberts, formerly a military official during a civilian official in the Obama administration, has pointed out, the air is transparent, the space is transparent, land is transparent. Why do you think the oceans are never going to be transparent? Number one. Number two, if you go down to 5 submarines, which is what these arms controllers want to do, only going to be 2 at sea at any one time, and the Russians know where they come from. They come from Washington State, Bangor, and Kings Bay in Georgia. Those are the only 2 bases you have. So they today follow them out to sea and try to track them now. We have brilliant technology that enables them to go out in the ocean and disappear. I'm not putting the whole shooting match on the idea that that will never change. And if you have 400-plus Minuteman out there, and you have bombers that you can get on the air, the idea that the Russians or Chinese can take us out and get rid of our ability to retaliate is crazy. They can't. But boy, get rid of Minuteman, stand down your bombers, go to five submarines. You just told the bad guys, we're going to make it very easy for you to come get us. And to me, talk about being, I mean, you're not preventing war. You're encouraging the bad guys to come after you.
Peter Husey, we have to leave it at that. It is not just crazy, as we've been saying. It is reckless. And the fact that anybody is in a senior position in the United States government who holds these views ought to be of alarm to all of us. Peter, thank you for your time. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Grant Newsham right after this.
Dan.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say we're joined for the first time by a man who I have not formally met, but I have been admiring from afar through the writing that he has been doing, particularly of late at And Magazine, a great online resource. His name is Grant Newsham. He is an attorney by training, a colonel now retired from the United States Marine Corps. He is also a former Foreign Service officer. These days, he is the senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies and a very welcome guest. It's good to have you, sir. Welcome aboard.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
I've been watching with some interest your writings about the trade agreement that President Trump is pursuing. Grant, and I was intrigued by basically the rather dim view that you take of this enterprise, partly because of the dubious track record of the Chinese when it comes to such things, particularly promises that they make that go unfulfilled, but also some of your thoughts as to whether Donald Trump is actually intent on winning this trade war. Talk us through that, if you would.
Yeah, I'm following the trade war like everyone else. And I will note that this is the first American administration ever that has actually tried to stand up to China and actually promote and protect U.S. interests. So it does. The administration deserves a lot of credit for that. And I'm very curious to see what kind of agreement is going to be reached. And one of the fundamental problems that I think will be a real sticking point is that the problem with China stealing intellectual property of the Americans and just about everyone else. And this has been going on for a long time, for decades. And if the whatever agreement is reached includes a promise by the Chinese that they will stop stealing this. And if that is presented as a success, I think one should have some real doubt. Any promise the Chinese have made in the past on these grounds, and really almost any promise they've ever made, is one that they're not going to keep. So exactly how this is going to be enforced and why this time China is going to abide by its promises about stealing intellectual property and any other trade matter is one that I think one should really be skeptical about. I don't think to this point the Trump administration has taken full advantage of its opportunities to cause some real pain to the Chinese, for example, shutting down ZTE, the telecoms company, really going after Huawei. They haven't done this when they've had a chance to really pin the Chinese. So we'll see how this goes. But I think, like a lot of people, I'm very curious. I would give Trump administration a lot of credit for actually having taken on China, but I'm skeptical about how this is going to turn out.
These are several really important points, and I think anyone who ignores the track record of the Chinese and invests too much in the prospect of future promises being performed on better than the previous ones is foolish and perhaps recklessly so. But the other question that occurs is, so why is it that the Trump administration seems not to have been pressing its advantage more assiduously when, as you say, particularly with cases of ZTE and Huawei, I think we've got considerable leverage. Is it a lack of commitment on the president's part He seems fairly firm and has been for many years, actually, long before he became president, on the fact that there is really a danger now emanating from China. So if it's not him doing it, who's to be blamed?
My suspicion is that there's two factions, at least within the administration, like every administration. And one of them includes people who do understand that the threat from China and do really want to have America play its hand properly and to really, as I said, cause some pain to China for the constant serial cheating that they've done. And then you have the other faction, and every administration has this, which you'd better call, say, the Wall Street crowd. And I think the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, probably typifies them. The guys who just want to cut a deal with China to sort of get things back on the status quo so everybody's making money.
Themselves included, usually, no?
Unfortunately, yes. I think you remember the first time that Mr. Trump went to China. He was going to really read the Riot Act to them. And then you notice that along with him were some American financial types and businessmen, I think with Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO, then CEO of Goldman Sachs, with them. And at that point, you knew that our chances of success had probably decreased by at least 50%. These are people who will appease, offer money. And, you know, once again, this is something every administration has to deal with. And I think you're seeing these competing factions sort of fighting it out, and it reflects itself in the ability of Mr. Trump to actually sort of play rough as it is. So we're getting almost a watered-down strategy, unfortunately, but that's my suspicion.
Well, I did want to just pay tribute to you for this wonderful line from your recent piece in The National Interest. You say, quote, President Trump appears to be getting advice on China policy from World Wrestling Entertainment. It's all starting to resemble a pro wrestling match where one wrestler gets his opponent in a headlock, throws him to the ground, and has him pinned for a long 2 seconds until he miraculously escapes. It's good theater, but it's tough on the audience, unquote. And I have to say, that really does capture whatever the motivation or the engineering of this policy is. It is troubling, to say the least, that the pinning isn't for keeps. Let me switch gears if I can, because I did want to ask you about another of the subjects that you've put your mind to that it seems to me is an important element of the threat we're facing from the Chinese. In fact, we had a statement about this in the rollout of a new group we call the Committee on the Present Danger China from Robert Charles, who you may have seen on Fox from time to time or may remember from his time as an Assistant Secretary of State with responsibility for narcotics and law enforcement affairs. And Robert has characterized this fentanyl business as really chemical warfare being waged by Communist China against this country. You've come to a similar kind of conclusion and suggest, as he does, that China could turn this off if they wanted to. Tell us about it.
Well, there's no question about it. Starting off with the idea that most of the fentanyl which is coming into the United States and killing about, goodness, at least 28,000 people a year, most of it originates in China. And the argument the Chinese make is, well, we can't stop it because we're so big and complex and we just can't do it. And you have Americans making their arguments for them, saying, well, the police in China can't really go after it. The laws won't allow them to, etc. I mean, they're acting like China is Canada. But no, China is a police state, and it can crack down on this sort of thing anytime it wants. And the law in China is whatever Xi Jinping says it is. And just note that if you, say, were to go out anywhere in China and you were to deface a picture of Xi Jinping, within minutes, you would be arrested and put into a jail or a mental hospital. And this is a police state, an incredibly capable surveillance state of the sort George Orwell could barely have imagined. And the idea that they cannot put a stop to the flow of these murderous drugs that are just causing carnage in America is basically, it's a lie. And anyone who would actually believe this, it just, on the American side at least, it just beggars the imagination. And so it is, think about it. If you track back, look at things like counterfeiting and any certain illegal drugs, illegal exports. it always tracks back to the Chinese government, to the security services, almost always. And this is really a fundamental issue. If China wanted to stop it, they could. They don't want to. As I say, they are killing thousands of Americans a year and making a lot of money
in the process. Yeah. We're paying them to kill us, in other words.
And the Obama administration did nothing about this. And even the Trump administration has been, should be talking about this in much more direct terms and regarding this for exactly what it is.
Grant Newsom, they certainly talk a lot about the opioid crisis. And I've heard many a administration spokesperson stitch into that, the fentanyl business. But you're absolutely right. It certainly seems they've fallen short in holding the Chinese directly accountable for this. And I think it was Robert who made the point that this seems a lot like retaliation against this country for what the Brits principally did to the Chinese in the bad old days of feeding them opium, which did a devastating thing to the Chinese population. But to your point about the police state and the security apparatus that's now in place, as you know, Grant, these guys are, and I think you were alluding to it a moment ago, these guys are now perfecting facial recognition and artificial intelligence and data mining and this incredible surveillance apparatus, which, by the way, they're raising funds for in American and other Western capital markets, no less. So, I mean, we know what kind of capability they have, and it is just mind-boggling that they're being allowed to get away with this kind of, I think of it, too, as chemical warfare against the American people.
But what you also raise another issue is the aiding and abetting by the American business and financial classes, and actually assisted by the regulatory class as well. That allows this kind of investment, this sort of financial flow to China, this sort of flow of technology that is being used really by an incredibly repressive state, and that sees America as its avowed enemy, and it seeks to displace us and dominate us. And to allow this to go on is just outrageous, and I suspect it will probably continue until really something really bad happens. Say war breaks out and then these guys can't cash their checks anymore. One can get pretty cynical about the willingness of our financial and business class, the professional CEO classes, to really sell their birthrights for a bowl of pottage.
Yeah, well, it'd be one thing if they were selling theirs. The trouble is they're selling ours as well. Grant Newsom, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you. Come back to us again soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being just about every week, by one of the smartest guys I know, David Goldman. He writes brilliantly at Asia Times under the nom de plume of Spengler. That is also the name he has used for his new novel on the subject of Chinese espionage entitled The Quantum Supremacy. You can find it at Amazon's Kindle Books. It's only available there, and I encourage you to take a look at it. We're going to have him back for a longer talk about it. But for the moment, we're going to visit with him about a host of other things. He is, among other achievements, the author of How Civilizations Die. And one of the things that we're going to visit with him about today is, are we watching the birth of a new empire, a new Chinese empire, that is? David Goldman, it's good to have you with us, as always. Welcome back.
Frank, it's a privilege. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Let me start with that question. There is a piece out, I think, in the past day or so from our friend Gordon Chang, about a Chinese super state. I think you have a disagreement about actually the form of this enterprise, but not so much the problem that it represents. Talk us through that, if you would.
Well, China is not we're not talking about the rise of a new empire. China is an ancient empire. We're talking about the ascendance of something very ancient and very nasty. There is no such thing as a Chinese nation until this generation. Only a tiny minority of Chinese could speak the same language. they communicated via the written ideograms, the imperial script, and paid tribute to a central authority in Beijing who collected their taxes. But there were 90 different languages and dozens of different ethnicities. The Chinese principle is you join our culture, you wear our clothes, you learn the characters, and then you become Chinese. The other alternative is we exterminate you. And you see them doing that to the Uyghur Muslim minority in Western China today. Chinese officials will tell you outright, we're just going to kill them all. It's what we've always done with barbarians on our borders. China now sees itself as the dominant force in the world, and the Chinese imperial principle will begin to absorb other countries like the Borg. Not that they're going to come in and change our political system the way the Russians wanted to with subversive movements and communist parties, but to make them economically and militarily subordinate to the Chinese empire, paying tribute to the Middle Kingdom. It's not a present prospect.
Yeah, whichever form this enterprise takes, as I say, it is not a pleasant prospect at all. One example of how unpleasant it can be that I did want to ask you about, David, is a report that I saw, I believe, out of the United Kingdom, if I'm not mistaken, that the Chinese, in addition to the aggressiveness with which they are building this surveillance state, as we talked about with Grant Nashram a moment ago, and the sort of destruction of churches and other acts of persecution against Christians and, for that matter, other faith communities. But apparently there is now a bounty being offered, a reward, if you will, for people ratting out where Christians are congregating in secret, these so-called house churches. I don't know if you can confirm that story or not, but would it surprise you if the Chinese are going to such lengths to try to essentially eliminate Christianity in their country?
I can't independently confirm the report, which I think I saw in the Daily Mail. However, the Chinese have always looked at anything with a Western connection as highly suspicious and something whose head they should cut off at the appropriate time. They're very paranoid about Western influence in their country. I do not believe that remonstrations with the Chinese government about human rights abuses are going to get us very far. On the other hand, I think that we should be ready to receive very large numbers of religious refugees who are leaving China because of the persecution. And I think the ultimate result of China's persecution will be like that, say, of the Spanish Inquisition in 1492. You end up losing your most talented and productive citizens who go on to enrich the cultures and economies of other countries. So I think we ought to be looking at a brain drain out of China.
Yeah. Are they, in fact, letting such people out? I hadn't been aware of that.
Well, it's pretty easy for Chinese to leave China. You can get tourist visas. They're very easy to obtain. Chinese tourists are flooding the world.
Yeah, but let me just ask you about that, David. As I understand this so-called social credit score, travel is one of the benefits that will be given to people who have a good credit score, which is to say they've found favor with the Chinese Communist Party. And I would imagine that Christians wouldn't qualify. Their scores would be rather low, would they not?
Well, there are, according to many reports, well over 100 million Christians in China. It's 10% of the population, perhaps, by some official estimates. There's no possible way for the Chinese government to try to eliminate Christianity. I think it's much more a matter of intimidating Christian leaders who they think might be inimical, might oppose in some fashion the rule of the Communist Party. But it's not hard for Chinese to leave as tourists. The question is, once they leave, where can they stay? I think the United States should have a program of identifying talented and American-friendly Chinese whom we wish to accept as legal immigrants. This is something President Trump has talked about many times. They need your talent. This is a very good opportunity to make the Chinese pay for their oppressive wickedness by losing a very large number of their most talented citizens.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting idea, and I think would have to be accompanied by an assiduous vetting process because of the extent to which we could wind up with some very bad apples indeed. But let me ask about one other thing, David Goldman. Your expertise is in matters of finance and the economy in particular. And I did want to ask you, there was a report in the Financial Times last week, which featured one of our longtime friends and colleagues, Roger Robinson, talking about some of the capital market activity of communist China that is resulting in some American investors, wittingly or probably mostly unwittingly, including institutional ones, putting money behind or into activities that most of us would find pretty unappealing, including the technologies and the companies behind the technologies that are being used for this social credit score surveillance and oppressing the Uyghurs and Christians and, for that matter, others. What are your thoughts on what's going on with respect to the Chinese raising money for such purposes in our capital markets?
Well, remember, the Chinese are net lenders to us. One of the principal demands that the Trump administration has made of China is that they open their own market to investment. They want American companies to be able to own 100% of subsidiaries instead of being stuck with a minority position with a Chinese partner. The banks in particular and money management firms are very anxious to get into China. So we are trying to open up investment. That's one of the principal demands, in fact, the Trump administration has made on the Chinese, and rightly so. On the other hand, I think Roger Robinson did the world a real service by identifying particular companies who are bad actors and involved in practices which we consider reprehensible. And I think very careful vetting of Chinese capital raising in the United States for its association with practices that we consider abusive and unacceptable is an extremely good thing to do.
Well, we will be, I'm hoping, covering this in much more detail in this program in the future. And I thank you very much for your expertise and time today. As always, it is one of the things that I think enriches my own understanding of the challenges that we're facing from communist China, David. And I wanted to say a special word of thanks to you for joining us in the new Committee on the Present Danger, China, which will, by the way, be having an event next Tuesday in Washington, where we will be bringing in some senior legislators and hopefully other members of the committee and folks who are not members of the committee, but with expertise on what the present danger that China represents is. And you, I know, can't be with us on this occasion, alas, but your insights and expertise is of great importance, I think, to the quality of the work that we're hoping to do to raise awareness about this great and growing challenge to our security as well as our economic prosperity and freedoms and the like. And I just, again, wanted to say from the bottom of my heart, David, how much I appreciate your help with that. Well, we have to leave it at that. I hope you'll come back to us again next week, David, and we hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.